This call is being recorded.
All right. Well, hello all. Thanks for joining us on the conference call. This is Ellie Hassenfeld, GiveWell's co-founder and co-executive director. Just a quick note right now is that we're recording this call and planning to post audio and maybe a transcript on our website after the call. If you say anything that you'd like us to remove, either from the recording or the transcript, Before we post it, please just send me an email, ellie@givewell.org, and we're happy to edit that before it goes live. Everyone right now is on mute because we're going to try to keep this as orderly as we can. We'll go through briefly how to ask questions so that you know what to do. Before we dive in, I want to just let the other GiveWell people here introduce themselves. So.
Hey, this is Holden.
Hi, I'm Catherine Hollander.
And I'm Josh Rosenberg.
Great. So the primary goal of this call is really to offer you all, the participants, an opportunity to ask the questions that you have. You know, we are really happy to answer basic questions about our top charities or our process. And please don't hesitate to ask something just because you think it's something that we cover somewhere else on our website. If at times in our answers, we may say, you know, this is something that we cover at X place on our site, and the only reason we're doing that is to help you track down more details. We definitely don't mean to imply that the only questions that should be asked are ones that we haven't already written about somewhere else. We know that there's a lot of material that can be hard to parse. So, you know, please do not hesitate to ask whatever questions are on your mind. I'm going to give a pretty brief summary of some of the major points from our research this past year in our process. And, you know, then I want to open things up for questions. If you'd like to ask a question, you know, there's a couple things you can do. You can use the chat feature in the Uber conference online site that we sent out before the call to just let us know that you have a question. You can also email me directly at ellie@givewell.org. That's ellie@givewell.org. And you can just please put conference call in the subject line. If you'd like to be unmuted, just put your phone number in the email so that I know who to unmute. And if you'd prefer to just send your question over email and have us ask it ourselves, we're also perfectly happy to do that. So without further ado, we're going to dive into the substance. One of the topics that we said we'd cover is our process for finding top charities. And so for those not familiar, want to just give a some basic background there. You know, our research process really starts with an assessment of the literature, the academic literature about a program. A program being something like deworming or bed nets or cash transfers, and we use that literature to filter the organizations we'll consider. We do that because, in our experience, most charities just don't have the type of evidence on hand that can demonstrate a causal impact for their programs. So we're looking for that causal evidence in randomized control in academic literature, which is often randomized control trials. And then we separately go and look for charitable organizations that can show they're implementing those programs well. And so in 2015, we largely were looking at charities that were working on programs that we've classified as priority programs. The full list of those programs is on our website, but generally speaking, they tend to be global health and nutrition programs, things like bed nets to prevent malaria, deworming to clear parasitic infections, cash transfers, nutritional supplementation programs, and immunizations. And so I think it's, you know, this starting point of academic literature is an important point of context to have about our research process. Overall, we have the same top charities at the end of this year as we did at the end of last year. Just at a very high level in terms of strengths and weaknesses, we see the Against Malaria Foundation, which funds bed net distributions, and the Deworm the World Initiative, which supports government deworming programs, as generally speaking, high-quality operations running very cost-effective programs. We see GiveDirectly, which provides cash transfers, as a very high-quality organization, but running a program that is less cost-effective in our assessment than the other programs our top charities work on. And then we see the Schistosomiasis Control Initiative, or SCI, as an organization that is running a very cost-effective program, But it's one that we've had communication issues with as an organization. So that kind of runs through the basics of the top charities, and you know I know that's all very high level, so happy to answer, you know, dive in anywhere that folks are interested. In terms of what's changed over the past year, generally speaking, you know, the overall we see a stronger case for our top charities this year than we did in past years. And to some extent that's because the organizations that we review now have longer track records. And we therefore have more evidence that they're able to implement the programs they do effectively. And then in some cases, we've also seen more and improved monitoring from organizations. That's particularly the case with respect to the Deworm the World initiative. Another big change is that we see significantly more room for more funding among our top charities. And what that means is that we believe that they can take in and utilize effectively significantly more funding than we thought they could take in last year. Commensurate with both of those considerations, we also expect more money moved to our top charities from donors this year than in past years. So we recommended significantly larger gifts to Good Ventures right at the end of this year than we had in past years, totaling approximately $44 million. For those who don't know, Good Ventures is a foundation started by Dustin Moskovitz, who's the co-founder of Facebook and Asana, and his wife, Carrie Tuna. That Good Ventures is their charitable foundation, and we've worked with them closely. In addition to the Good Ventures, you know, this recommendation to Good Ventures, we expect donations from individuals to be significantly larger than they were last year. All told, we directed about $13 million from individuals in 2014, and we expect that to roughly double this year. So all around, we see more money moved. You know, because of these facts, that you know, more room for more funding and more money moved, we've put a lot more thought into this concept of room for more funding and how to assess the organization's funding gaps and the relative impact of different amounts of funding could have for each of them. And so, you know, that's something we wrote a lot about in our blog post, and I'm not planning to dive into the details there, but we've put significantly more thought into that, and if anyone is interested, happy to sort of go into that in more detail. Finally, I just want to briefly touch on some of our future plans, because I know it's something that we've now begun to think pretty seriously about as we come out of 2015 and look towards next year. We certainly plan to continue to follow the organization's that we've already recommended and are expecting to move significant amounts of money to very closely. We have built up a lot of capacity internally. Some of that is for the Open Philanthropy Project, another research initiative that we're working on. But we do hope that a good portion of that capacity can help deepen our understanding of our current top charities and lead to potentially new top charities on our list. Some of the ways that we hope to do that are first completing more assessments of the academic literature in areas where we have yet to do so. In some cases, that is looking at programs that are similar to the ones that we recommend today. So programs like additional immunization programs, additional nutrition programs, and more neglected tropical diseases, which are ones that we haven't looked at yet. But also looking at newer programs, you know, programs that have make strong claims of cost effectiveness, but we haven't had the capacity to look at them in the past. And I think the best example of that program area is surgical programs, where often charitable organizations make claims of extreme cost effectiveness, you know, something like $50 per blindness averted. And this is something that we do hope to look into next year if we're able to go forward with that research. And then we'd also like to revisit areas like education, family planning, though it's less clear whether we'll be able to do that. And then finally, we've written a little bit about our area of focus that we've called GiveWell Experimental. And, you know, the idea there is trying to support the development of future GiveWell top charities. And so, you know, this is something that we have yet to have the capacity to really devote our full attention to. But in the long term, we think providing some funding to organizations that potentially could be on our list 3 to 5 years from now is a worthwhile endeavor. So without further ado, I want to open things up for questions. So again, If you'd like to ask a question and would like me to unmute you, please just either use the chat feature through the web interface of the Uber conference line, or send an email to ellie@givewell.org, ELIE@givewell.org, and just put your phone number in the subject line, and then I can pretty easily include you. So just to start things off, I'm going to unmute Richard. You emailed in some questions earlier today, so I'm going to unmute you, and why don't you go ahead and just ask one of the questions that's on your list.
So your EMF review states that right now your cost effectiveness for estimate for bed nets is $2,838 per life saved. Accurate reflection of your research to say that 1/2,838th of a life is saved every time you donate $1 to your EMF?
Sorry, Richard, can you just clarify your question? I'm not sure I follow what you're asking. Are you asking whether it's kind of literally the case that every additional $3,000 that's donated, like, we expect an additional life to be saved?
I know you say that there's a lot of uncertainty with that estimate, so I'm just wondering if it's an accurate characterization to say that every time you donate $3,000 to EMF, a life is saved.
Yeah, I mean, I think the quick answer is that I don't think we wouldn't say anything like that literally. I mean, I think first of all, the cost effectiveness estimates we use are subject to, many assumptions. And, we use these analyses as a way of making sure that we've asked all the questions we can of a program to think about what could happen that would lead it to being ineffective. Certainly with BedNets, the process of putting together this analysis has helped us do that and think about questions like the impact of insecticide resistance or the impact that could come from people not using nets as often as they should. And then the second reason we do these is to try and compare two programs to each other and say, what would we say is the relative cost effectiveness of bed nets versus cash transfers or versus deworming? But I don't think that, we would say anything like we have high confidence that $3,000 on expectation saves a life, never mind the fact that, because of the way AMF works, where it has to batch up lots of donations together to finalize multi-million dollar deals to distribute nets, I don't think we can realistically, we wouldn't say that you should expect that when you give $3,000, it, directly leads to a life being saved. All right, we're going to move on to Jake. Jake, I think you chatted that you wanted to ask a question, so why don't you shoot?
Excellent. Thanks. Can you hear me now?
Yep, we hear you.
Awesome. Thanks again for doing this call. Definitely very interesting. My question is about long-term versus short-term impacts of different interventions. I know if you give someone cash, obviously they can earn potentially compounding returns on that year after year. And I imagine there's an analog to that. If someone's life gets saved today, they become a productive member of their community. They could help someone else. They could potentially get a different disease later. So I'm curious, how do you weigh, the very clear, you either have cash today or you don't, you have a bed net today or you don't, versus whatever knock-on secondary and third order effects might happen in future years?
Sure. So I think we have direct evidence on the long-term effects of deworming only from a high-quality randomized control trial. So the only long-term impacts that we have direct evidence for are on deworming. And there are some other studies that also, some observational studies that look at the long-term effects of things like bed nets. But right now the literature for cash is looking at pretty short-term impacts. I think the follow-up on the GiveDirectly RCTs are only at 1 year. On the big picture question of how you compare like the knock-on versus the direct effects, I think that we don't have a confident way to compare the knock-on effects of the interventions to each other because, you know, they're just, I think it's difficult to study that question. And so the main way that our current cost-effectiveness analyses account for, and you know, our research as a whole accounts for long-term effects is by looking at high-quality studies of the long-term effects.
Yeah, and I think, go ahead, Jake.
I was just going to ask if, based on either intuition or like early data, is there, would you suspect that there are more better long-term effects from cash or other things that haven't had the rigorous studies yet, or is it just too soon to tell?
I think it's pretty speculative in the case of cash. I mean, you can try to do things like compare cash to similar programs. So, you know, one example is that evidence on a program called Targeting the Ultra Poor was recently released. They did 6 RCTs of a program that basically gives families cows or other assets along with, you know, some other support. And that RCT follows up at, I think, 4 years and 6 years after starting the program and finds, you know, long-term effects. So you can kind of use that as a proxy because or you can think of that as a possible proxy because people frequently spend cash on similar assets. But I think that, you know, that's still pretty speculative at this point, and we are, you know, hoping to see direct evidence of the long-term effects on cash before really incorporating that into our, you know, estimate of how effective cash is.
Yeah, I mean, just to sort of sum up, I mean, I would guess that we're not, that like our way of assessing costs and benefits is not like either is not biased in favor of or against any of the programs. I mean, I think we're trying to make as reasonable an assessment of the overall costs and benefits of these programs as we can, with the recognition that, you know, we're often having to we just have like limited information, particularly about the very long term effects.
Makes sense. Thanks.
All right. Well, let's, Maddie, I want to unmute you. Why don't you ask the question that you have?
Okay. Hi. Thank you very much. My name is Maddie Marasciullo, and I am the U.S. representative for Malaria Consortium. It's an NGO based in the U.K., and in addition to doing malaria, we do NTDs as well as most things to do with child health. We are in Africa and Asia. And so my question... first of all, I wanted to say that I was very happy to hear that you do a lot of research and that you like to work with charities which provide evidence because we are a research-based organization. And you mentioned nutrition, immunization. You also mentioned bedness, which I assume you're interested in prevention of malaria. And so my question is in relationship to, we've done 2 studies in Nigeria, which have led to us doing a very large scale implementation in 7 African countries to implement what's called seasonal malaria chemoprevention, which is basically a mass drug administration of antimalarials to children under 5. And we have found that it has an amazing effect in terms of reducing malaria by 68%. But what we also found in the process was that the cost of implementing this, WHO initially said it would cost about $1.50 per child. We are finding it costing close to $4 per child. So you can imagine how expensive such a program is, particularly when I think there's an estimated 34 million children that can be targeted to receive this. So my question has to do more with, we are very interested in trying to figure out ways in which we can reduce the cost and take advantage of sort of an MDA type of approach and using it with other programs, nutrition being one and deworming being another. So how could we sort of merge a way of getting these other types of intervention that require either house-to-house visits or having, you know, fixed group of people coming to a fixed location in a community And is that something that you would be interested in funding if we provided the evidence for that?
Got it. Thanks. I mean, our main take on a program like this is to ask the question, how cost effective is it? What's the evidence base and how does it compare to the other options? So that is that's the type of information we'd be looking for, we'd dig into to decide whether and how to move forward. Certainly if there were if we found a cost effective opportunity to provide, recommend funding to a group that was doing this, we'd be very excited about it. So I think basically this is not a program area that I'm familiar with. I mean, I've heard about it, but I don't know it well. And so I think we would need to do a little more work to really give a thoughtful answer to what type of information we'd be looking for. We also don't tend to play the role of, really like any type of advisor or even connector between groups. I mean, we know some of the deworming organizations and the nutrition organizations, and so if we can be helpful in putting you together, we're happy to try and do that. But the main role that GiveWell plays is looking for opportunities that exist or opportunities that could exist in the near future, and then providing support to try and make those opportunities to see whether those are ultimately top charities.
Okay. Thank you very much. I appreciate that. Perhaps we can be in contact offline.
Yeah, that would be great. Please send me an email. I'd love to hear more details about that. I'm going to move to Eric. I'm going to let you ask your question now.
Thanks, Ellie. Can you hear me now?
Yep, I hear you.
Yeah, so I have a question about the standout charities. I was wondering if you think that there might be any what you describe as capacity-relevant issues for any of the standouts where larger donations might be able to have a leverage impact, maybe by allowing them to expand their programs in some way, beyond simply the kind of the cost per unit benefit of the program.
Yep, got it. It's a good question. So I think it really goes case by case. So I'll do the easier ones first. I mean, I think with Living Goods is the standout charity that we followed least closely in 2015 because, we would need to see significantly improved cost effectiveness and monitoring from Living Goods to see them as a real potential top charity. And so I don't know whether those types of opportunities exist with Living Goods. Development Media International, the group that does mass media broadcasts to promote improved health behaviors, I think that they probably do have some capacity building funding opportunities. I think if you look in the room for more funding section of our review, you'll see some of the campaigns that they want to open up. And because they are still a relatively young organization, they have worked in relatively few places over the last, over their history. And therefore having the opportunity to work in more places probably would potentially have some of those capacity relevant type opportunities that we talked in the blog post about. We are kind of holding off on pushing that recommendation further right now because because the results from the randomized control trial were sort of disappointing in Burkina Faso. But we do remain pretty excited about Development Media International as an organization because they've shown this commitment to monitoring and evaluation, and they've been extremely transparent and communicative with us. And so, we do still plan to talk more to them about what they might plan down the line with the possibility that they might become a future GiveWell top charity, depending on, what they do next. Finally, with the two groups that work on salt iodization, one is the Iodine Global Network. They are really small. Their annual budget is in the, $800,000 to $1 million level. We expect them to end the year with some funding gap. On some level, it's like every dollar you give to them seems potentially leveraged because what they are is an advocacy organization that is trying to encourage governments to either maintain, improve, or implement salt iodization programs. On the other hand, we have really struggled to understand their track record and be convinced that they have had a significant impact on salt iodization in the areas that they've worked. And so, that's what's held us back in their case. And then finally, there's the Global Alliance for Improved Nutrition. Their acronym is GAIN, and you know their salt iodization program. And you know, in GAIN's case, we looked at them closely this year. We did a site visit to Ethiopia. We then had some communication issues with them where we were able to learn things on the site visit that we hadn't been able to find out from the U.S. And, you know, that raised some concerns for us about our ability to follow them. And that's why we, ultimately didn't end up being confident in recommending them. We'll be publishing that full review soon. But nevertheless, they're an entity that I think actually right now has a significant need for funding. They, I think, are low on resources, and funding to them could make a significant impact to their ability to continue the salt iodization work that they're undertaking. And so I think putting that all together, I think largely in the case of the sort of biggest opportunities on that front in our standouts are with the iodization organizations. And in both cases, I think if you are maybe more generous to the cost effectiveness of those programs than we have been, if you are, if you require less of a demonstrable track record of impact from the organizations, both IGN and GAIN seem like pretty good giving opportunities, because I do think there's some leverage. And, we are waiting to see the stronger track record, and also, don't see the cost effectiveness as strong enough to really overwhelm the case for the, deworming or bed net organizations. And that's why we recommended those more highly.
Thank you.
Great. Let's see. So, Kyle, I think you wanted to ask a question. So let me, do you want to ask the question that you had? Guess not. Okay. Let's move on. So we're going to go back to Richard. Richard, do you want to ask another one of the questions that you were asking about?
Right. From my understanding, you don't expect the Gates Miliary Foundation to close its executive level one funding gap, the donations of Dot Good Venture donors this year. So given that, do you think it's not really that valuable to get even more top tiers since we can't even close their level one funding gap?
So I think one of the major reasons that we're looking into potential new top charities is because we're wondering whether there are, potentially more cost-effective giving opportunities out there than AMF. So that would be one major advantage of finding a new top charity that, wouldn't necessarily be affected by whether AMF funding gap is closed. An additional reason, even if AMF were to remain the top charity on our list, or the charity that could best use additional funds to have additional top charities, is that, we, for one, are somewhat uncertain about, how quickly AMF will be able to move funds out the door. So it's possible that, we give AMF a substantial amount of money this year, or that it meets its, funding gap over the course of the next couple of years, and that's kind of sufficient for it to operate over the following year or two. Although, we're very uncertain about how quickly it'll move funds out the door. It's possible that if that were to happen, that having additional top charities would be valuable. We're hopeful that in the long term we'll have significantly more money moved, and so it seems better to have a more robust list with multiple charities to absorb kind of all the funding that could potentially go to our top charities in the future.
Great. Jake, do you want to ask, another, you had another question too?
I did, yeah, and it was actually very closely related to the last topic. Just thinking kind of a hypothetical, let's say that you all become much more successful in terms of the amount of money moved today. You're expecting to double off last year. Let's say it was 10x as much or 100x as much. What do you think is the next highest best use of that donation money? Do you think you would direct it to the standouts that are not yet on the top? Do you think you'd build out the GiveWell organization? Like, what do you think after the top charities, if you had a bunch more money to direct, where would it go?
Yeah, so I mean, I think at this point, you know, there's roughly $200 million worth of room for more funding among our top charities. You know, I think beyond that, we'd have to start thinking pretty seriously about what to do, and we might even start encouraging donors to wait and, you know, wait for us to do more research, to find more options, because I think that it's not entirely, you know, we don't really see the standouts as the next best opportunities after the four top charities. They're in some ways the next four that we know of, but they're not being treated in exactly the same way. And so I don't think we would just tell people to give significant amount of money there. I do think that this would be like potentially a relatively short-term issue in that, you know, GiveDirectly is an organization that I think has the capacity long-term to move a huge amount of money. And the main thing holding their growth back right now is a lack of funding that they need to move out the door, and then a lack of experience at higher and higher levels of funding. And so I think at a certain point, I would expect, GiveDirectly, which runs a program which, you know, I think is we see as less cost effective than the other organizations on our list, but still like an extremely good way to spend charitable dollars. You know, I think that GiveDirectly has the ability to take in just a huge amount of additional funding over the long term.
Yeah, I would add a quick clarification that there are some giving opportunities. We're segmenting not just by quality, but by kind of fit with donors. So there's some stuff that Open Philanthropy Project does, or opportunities that are more speculative, higher risk, that, you know, or including actually GiveWell direct support operations, that we think of as kind of, you know, maybe better opportunities than our top charities in our opinion, but not nearly as able to be verified and backed up with the kind of evidence and rigor that we go for. And so there's the stuff that we think of as kind of first in the queue, but not the best fit for individual donors. Then there's the top charities. And then if we ran out of top charities room, we were still making recommendations to individual donors, we'd look for something else that was a good fit for individual donors. So I think it's just worth clarifying that ordering.
Got it. That's really helpful. Thanks.
All right. I'm going to ask a couple questions that were just, emailed in, and so I'll just read them off. So, you know, one of the questions was, how would you think about weighing your different recommended charities against each other and making a decision between them? In other words, how would a donor decide which one of them to donate to?
Sure. So I think that there are, you know, a few different profiles of donors that you could imagine. And, you know, you could think about how they would give differently between our top charities. So I think one thing to recognize at first is that, the Against Malaria Foundation is really focused on saving under five lives, whereas the deworming organizations and the cash transfer organization is focused on improving lives. The deworming organizations, the main benefit that we're thinking about there is basically improving children's long-term income. If you value one of those more relative to the other one, then you might want to think about, giving accordingly. I think another sort of profile of donor that you could think about is someone who really wants to be sure that their donation is having an impact. And for that type of donor, I think the cash transfers, GiveDirectly is probably the best opportunity, just because, you're giving cash to very poor families in the developing world, and we're highly confident that it's reaching them and that it has some positive benefit, whereas the, you know, other top charities are doing somewhat more complicated interventions where issues could arise, you know, like in the case of bed nets, it's possible that insecticide resistance could be a significant factor in reducing the impact. It's possible that, you know, AMF could take a while to disperse funds, and so you wouldn't have a significant positive impact in the very near future. In the case of deworming, I think it's important to keep in mind that the evidence there is very complicated and uncertain. I think that we wrote in our blog post that most GiveWell staff would bet that, you know, deworming more likely than not has very little or no impact, but the potential for, you know, a large impact is significant enough that, you know, the cost effectiveness looks good. So, you know, there's significant variation in sort of how confident you can be in your impact between the top charities. And yeah, those are a couple of considerations.
Yeah, I'd also point you to the table in the blog post that we put out last week on the new top charity announcement, which weighs all these factors against each other, so you can kind of see how we've weighted them as well.
Yeah, and so just to, I agree with everything that Josh and Catherine said, and a couple other things that I'd add. If you put the I think like one, if you just want to do like what we recommend, the sort of biggest, most pressing funding gap we see right now is giving to the Against Malaria Foundation. I think that donors have different preferences about how much to outsource their thinking, so to speak, to GiveWell. But if you are really just saying like, what's the sort of GiveWell view? I just want to do what they say. I think right now it's give to AMF. All right, I'm going to ask a couple other questions, and then we'll try to answer them. So, you know, one of the questions was, and I think Holden, you should jump in on this one.
Okay.
Can you explain why Open Philanthropy is looking at criminal justice reform and factory farming in light of GiveWell's focus on global poverty? You know, which is where we, you know, the needs are furthest and dollars go further.
Sure. I mean, Open Philanthropy is trying to broaden out and explicitly drop some of the original criteria we had. And, you know, GiveWell was originally aimed at individual donors, and so we looked for things that we thought we could really stand behind with strong evidence, with strong track records. That led us to a focus on kind of simple, linear, direct, you know, direct aid programs. And I think within that category, we did come to the conclusion that the needs are greatest and the money goes furthest in the developing world. But things change quite a bit once you take away that restriction. And so, for example, I mean, there's certainly arguments that the amount of suffering, the number of beings, and the opportunities to make a difference are actually even greater for factory-farmed animals than they are for people in the developing world. Now, which is one of those do you prioritize? That's a huge judgment call. That's a philosophical question. And I don't have the answer, and that's why, you know, we do some work on both, but I think it's at least defensible to work on, you know, reducing the suffering of factory-farmed animals. I think there's a strong argument that that does actually do more good than these direct aid programs for the developing world, but it's not as direct, it's not as proven, it's more of a fit for open fill. Similarly with criminal justice reform, you know, there's political opportunity there of a type that I don't see with foreign aid or even foreign aid-related policy issues. And so when you think about the idea that political opportunity could lead into situations where you spend a small amount of money and then you influence an actor such as government that's way more powerful and involves way more money than a philanthropist, you can get a multiplier. And again, there's an argument you can do more good there than you can do with the direct GiveWell work. And so, you know, what I'm not saying right now is that I know the answer. What I am saying is that all the things we're doing are things that could be defended or could turn out to be, when we understand them better, could turn out to be the best way to do good. And when those things don't fall into the category of direct aid, they're going under open philanthropy, but we're exploring them all right now.
Great. So another question that came in is, you know, following up on the question earlier, is there a reasonable way to say that, you know, your X dollars will save one life? I think Ellie was saying earlier that, you know, we wouldn't suggest that people literally say that $3,000 to AMF saved a life, but I think this person is asking, is there some reasonable claim then that can be made? Is there a reasonable way to communicate that message?
Yeah, I mean, it's not the type of claim that I think is like one that I really like making that often, because I think it's, you know, it's pretty fraught with nuance and complication. And so it's, you know, the reason we don't lead with those figures on our website has a lot to do with the fact that, you know, I think that charities make many outlandish claims about the cost effectiveness of their programs. And, you know, we'd rather sort of lead with the fact that these opportunities are incredibly cost effective, in incredible ways to help people. But, you know, trying to boil it down to some highly confident dollar figure, I think, ends up often being more problematic than it's worth. So there's certainly cases where I think it can be useful. You know, if you're just trying to give someone some sense of, you know, what what something costs and how much it accomplishes. The $3,000 per life saved, the 50 cents per child dewormed, you know, those types of figures can be useful, but I definitely think it's worth being cognizant of the complication. I'm just going to ask a couple more that have, come in over email, and, you know, we don't have a ton more people who are asking, you know, want to ask questions. So, you know, we're about 2/3 of the way through the call. If you're interested in asking a question, the queue is not so long. So, you know, feel free to, you know, jump in, email me at ellie@giveWell.org. That's ELIE@giveWell.org, or use the chat feature on Uber Conference. And, you know, when you do that, please just let me know if you'd like to be unmuted so you can ask yourself. There our slight preference is to do that so people don't just have to listen to us talk the whole time, but we're certainly happy to keep reading questions for people who'd rather have us do that. A couple more that have already come in that I'm just going to read. So Holden, I think you can answer this one.
Mm-hmm.
Should other donors who have historically made regular donations to GiveWell top charities but were not influenced by GiveWell change their donation behavior based on the good venture grants we recommended, or the money moved we expect, or have we already calculated those donation streams into our room for more funding analysis? So, you know, for example, should donors who follow, who use giving what we can to decide where to give, should they alter their recommendation or their decision, or specifically should giving what we can alter their recommendation of deworm the world because of our recommendation, or have we already taken into account that, you know, have we taken those donations into account in our analysis?
Sure. We tried to take all the donations into account, and when donations are non-GiveWell donations, when we feel like they don't depend on us and they're not about GiveWell, then we've tried to just count them as if they're money in the bank, as if they're revenue, and we've done our best estimate of that. So that's the quick answer. I think specifically on Deworm the World, Ellie, did we forecast revenue for Deworm the World and, like, include giving what we can? And, like, what was the number we forecast there?
So, you know, what we tried to do for all our top charities was look at, you know, try to forecast, like, all revenues that they would receive, GiveWell and otherwise. We have limited information about the revenue that they expect to receive, and so often it was just based on the revenues they had received in the past.
Yeah.
But we use those figures of total direct GiveWell influenced money and total other money, and we use that to inform our estimates. And so in the case of giving what we can and deworm the world, giving what we can dollars would have been excluded from our analysis.
Do you remember specifically with deworm the world, like, did we have a, like, do you know how much we estimated they were going to take in other than us?
It was a small amount of money,
right?
Like, on the order of like $500,000.
I think that's important, because it's like, if, you know, we're kind of calculating that deworm the world would be pretty full up on money after what we're recommending, plus like another $500,000. So anyone who's thinking of sending more than $500,000 there in any way, including via recommendation, I think should rethink that.
Cool. And then one more question that sort of relates to the GiveWell and Open Philanthropy grant recommendations. Will GiveWell or Open Philanthropy make grant recommendations on the order of, you know, $500 million within this year or within the next calendar year, as outlined, Holden, in that post that you wrote?
Yeah, I think the answer is no. The post, you know, laid out what level of giving is kind of our budget, but we don't, you know, if we're not sitting here saying our mission for the year is to spend that much money. If we did that, we would run things very differently, and I think we would do things much worse from a long-term perspective. So, you know, we're not stressing about trying to hit every target number, and I don't think we're going to come anywhere near hitting that target number this year. We just don't have the staff and the knowledge yet to be at that level of giving. So, I'm not going to rule it out if something comes along, but I think it's extremely unlikely. I think that, you know, the number is not going to be a lot higher than what you're seeing. And certainly to top charities, we're not planning anymore.
Great. So on a very different topic, a question that someone asked is, you know, did we look at microfinance at all? How are we thinking about microfinance, and, you know, where do we see them as fitting in relative to our top charities?
Sure. So we spent a lot of time looking into microfinance earlier in GiveWell's history, and really tried to break apart the evidence base there. And after thinking about it and reviewing the studies, we determined that microfinance wasn't, a priority program that was potentially competitive with things like cash transfers and bed nets, because you know there are some randomized controlled trials on microfinance, and they generally don't seem to find significant effects on reduction of poverty or high return on investment from receiving microfinance. So we decided to deprioritize looking into microfinance charities.
Yeah, and if you sort of want, this is not an area we've looked at closely in the recent past, but if you years ago we looked into it a great deal. If you Google GiveWell microfinance, you'll land on a page which summarizes our view as of May 2012, which was the last time we really went into this, and it links out to all the work we did, including some deep dives of a large number of microfinance institutions to look at the data that they had available. So if you want more information, that's the best place to look. Richard, I think you had some more questions, so I'm going to come back and to you and see if there's anything else you'd like to ask.
Oh, I have more questions than we have time for. Evidence Action is a parent organization of DeepWorth World. I don't have a really good feeling of what exactly this means. Do they influence DeepWorth World's program, or do they just provide funding? Do they share personnel and office space?
Yeah, so the question is about Evidence Action, which is the parent organization of DeepWorth World, and how do they share office space? How do they work together? I think the right way to think about it is that, Deworm the World is a project of Evidence Action. And so Jeff Brown, who's the current CEO of Evidence Action, is responsible for all three of Evidence Action's main program areas, Dispensers for Safe Water, Deworm the World Initiative, and Evidence Action Beta. And so they very much have, overlapping staff. I think the main ways in which my understanding is the staff overlap, and the reason they want to maintain a structure where a single organization is the parent for multiple program areas is because they get these savings on overhead and administration by putting the programs together. And so you need one finance department, one accountant. And you don't need to double up on those types of activities. And so they, they believe that the costs that, they bear in terms of complexity of communication and, certainly making it a little bit more difficult on GiveWell's side to, know exactly where the funds are going is worth it in terms of the savings in overhead. All right, Jake, I think you said you had another question, so why don't you ask your question?
Sure. I read somewhere, I'm not sure if it's actually true, that in the places where Against Malaria Foundation and other similar programs operate, there's effectively no private market to buy mosquito nets. And I'm just curious about that in particular, and more broadly, how you think about the potential effects on a local economy that giving either a good or a service or directly cash might distort and change the local economy.
Yep, got it. It's definitely the fact that giving bed nets in some way reduces the likelihood that local private manufacturers will spring up to produce bed nets. Is a real potential downside. Similarly, the fact that outside donors provide bed nets, other things equal, makes it less likely that governments will provide those nets themselves rather than, getting the funding from outside donors. I think it's just important to weigh those costs against the, very real benefit of giving someone something like a malaria net, which is a device that, is going to save lives. And so for us, there's the, potential downside, but it seems, relatively limited because there've been many places over the past, decade. And so that's since the time that it became well accepted that insecticide treated nets were a highly cost-effective way to save lives, that people have not had the nets that they needed, and private development hasn't sprung up to provide those nets. And it took a long time, you know, and so because, you know, I think it is reasonable to believe that, you know, in the absence of that funding, you know, many people will still lack this good. And so while there, you know, is some sort of, you know, small long-term deterrent, I think small long-term deterrent to let private investment you know, government provision of services, I think it's like small relative to that benefit. And in the absence of providing that funding, I think it truly wouldn't be provided, at least in the foreseeable future.
Yeah. And one additional argument in favor of, you know, the public sector or nonprofits providing bednets is that bednets have some, you know, positive externalities. If your neighbor's sleeping under a bednet, then you're less likely to get malaria. And so, you know, it sort of makes sense that the full benefits wouldn't be captured by an individual, and so they might be less likely to buy it than would be ideal.
That makes a ton of sense. Thanks.
All right. Well, let's see. Melanie, I'm going to unmute you in case you want to ask your question yourself. If you'd rather we read it, we're happy to do that. All right. So we're just going to I think this question is just around, you know, how much of our data and formula do we, you know, do we make open for, you know, the general public to interact with? And just generally speaking, I mean, we try to make as much as we of our research and the inputs into that research public so that people can look at it themselves. So just as one example, you know, anyhow, all of the charity reviews we do are fully public, and you can pretty much track down all the things we're talking about on this call to the, you know, in the review themselves and in the footnotes. When it comes to the analysis, you know, something like our cost effectiveness analysis, you know, you can download the Excel file that we did those analyses in and plug in your own values and reach your own conclusions about the relative cost effectiveness of the programs. So this, you know, we definitely aim to make as much of this information understandable and usable by the general public so that people can, you know, kind of use it to inform their giving decisions on their own. Let's see, Maddie, I think you had another question, so I'm gonna let you ask that if you're up for it.
Hello?
Yeah, do you want to ask your question?
Oh, sure, I just put it in there, but fine. No, I was just interested to know, now with the new Sustainable Development Goals, which seem to be very heavily weighted on poverty and economic growth, will that influence your decision-making in terms of new charity?
Yep, good question. So, you know, I don't think it'll influence us directly. You know, the criteria that we're going to use are, you know, the evidence base for the program. So, you know, how strong the evidence is and how large the impact is, the cost effectiveness, the room for more funding, you know, whether we see opportunities for marginal donations to make a difference, and then transparency, you know, whether the organization that we're considering is ready and willing to really be a total open book to us and let us, you know, understand them and share that publicly. And so something being, you know, a Millennium Development Goal or a Sustainable Development Goal, that itself is not, you know, is not directly going to influence our assessment.
Okay, thank you.
Yep. Okay, Richard, I'm going to go back to you and let you ask a question in a second, and just want to remind everyone, if you have, you know, more questions, now's a good time to email in or use the chat interface to let me know. If you'd like to ask your question, note that. If you'd rather we just read it, please note that. And, you know, we're happy to sort of answer them. And I think that we, but, you know, if we don't get too many more, we'll probably wrap up shortly. So, Richard, I'm gonna go back to you now, and why don't you ask one of your remaining questions.
Hey, insecticide resistance with respect to malaria. It's my understanding that, you know, this is a important, potentially an important future consideration. I'm given to understand, based on your page on the topic, that monitoring and reporting changes in the malaria burden following insecticide net distributions, or insecticide-treated net distributions, is very important. I understand that AMF has been trying to, you know, collect this data, you know, the changes in malaria burden following their distribution, but this data is kind of sketchy, but they're trying to do it better in the future. And I understand that you aren't going to be following AMF's progress as, you know, of their monitoring of the change in malaria burden in the future. That's my understanding. I might not be right. It seems like an important thing to keep track of. What's your reason behind that?
So I think you're asking about AMF's long-term tracking of malaria cases in the places that it distributes nets.
Yeah.
Let me address that. I agree with you that conceptually, if AMF were able to get data on malaria cases in the places it distributes nets, that would give us a significant amount of information about its success in general, but also specifically with respect to insecticide resistance. Because if it's truly reducing malaria cases, then insecticide resistance is clearly not a major issue. The problem is that the data that AMF was able to collect was just not of high enough quality to be useful in understanding whether or not the malaria cases were truly falling. So just to sort of illustrate one type of problem that I believe they experienced, in many cases in Africa, if someone has a fever, they'll go to the clinic, and it may be the clinician's discretion about whether to classify that visit as due to malaria or due to something else. More recently, many clinics have what are called rapid diagnostic tests on hand, and so they're able to, kind of do a very quick, simple, objective test of whether or not someone has malaria. And so in a world where all the clinics had rapid diagnostic tests, it would be relatively straightforward, at least in places where most of the people who have malaria actually present at a clinic, to collect the data, aggregate it, and sort of send it up the chain and allow AMF to have access to it. But in many places that AMF was going, there, I think, is not sufficient access to these RDTs. In some cases, some clinics will have them some of the time, but then other times they'll be stocked out and clinicians are then using their discretion. And so instead of having sort of a clean data set that evaluates malaria cases objectively, you end up looking at data that's very noisy because it reflects clinicians' discretion about how to classify various illnesses at different points in time. We're going to go to Dan, and unless anyone else emails in, I think Dan may be the last question.
Yes, thank you. Can you hear me?
Yep, we hear you.
All right, great. Sort of basic question. When I'm around the Thanksgiving table with the family and I'm trying to describe what it is you folks do and why it's a good thing, I sort of am at a loss to have a soundbite as to what it is that transparency and evidence-based analysis means. In other words, why the common charities that everyone's heard of, the CARES and the Red Crosses, don't make these lists. Do you have a soundbite or an elevator talk on, just a few sentences of how you could explain to someone what it is that you guys provide that distinguishes your charity picks from the big well-known guys?
Yeah, so we're looking for the best giving opportunities that we can find as far as lives saved or improved. And we're looking for places that we feel like we can recommend that donors give with high confidence, where they know that they're having an impact as far as lives saved or improved. And, in a lot of cases in the charitable world, like there isn't a lot of information about what donations are doing or how effective programs are. And so what we are is a resource for donors who are interested in, identifying places where they really feel like their donation can have that kind of impact.
All right, thank you.
Great. Well, I think with that, unless anyone else, kind of emails in or chats in at the last minute, we've been on for about an hour, so I think we're going to wrap up. Just really appreciate all of you being interested in joining and talking through these questions with us. We really appreciate your interest, your intellectual engagement, and your following our work. It's something that we we've grown in the audience size has grown at GiveWell over the last few years, and it's something that, you know, both Holden and I are extremely grateful for, to have, you know, people who are happy to take an hour out of their afternoon or evening and chat with us about some of the research that we've done. So thank you very much. We really appreciate it. And, you know, we hope that you'll just feel free to email in any additional questions that you have that, you know, you'd really like us to answer that we haven't answered already. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.